Dreaming about being a big star. They say you're basic, they say you're easy. You're always riding in the backseat. Now I'm smiling from the stage while you were clapping.
Chapter 2. So Ed starts spending a lot of time at Mustang's house. They aren't doing more dinners out. Not yet. According to the comms director, they have to play discreet now before toting him around like a discount handbag. Something about how it'll make Mustang look serious about this investment. Like he was dicking around at first and then went, "Oh shit," and dragged Ed home over his shoulder. Before all the other leopards realize he caught the fattest gazelle on the shell and come to get their piece. So Ed's job is to hang out and do whatever. He starts bringing chowder on day 2, because might as well put Mustang's yard to use, and starts systematically strip mining Mustang's library. It's not the biggest collection, but right away Ed spots the Amstrian principle, which is illegal outside of the national libraries, and only kept as dissident bait besides, practically poking out at eye level. "Aren't you going to get arrested if someone finds this?" he says, taking the book down. He's probably not going to read it. It's not like the Amstrian government being an evil shit show is going to come as news. But it's an indicator that Mustang has more serious stuff here than every Fuhrer's memoirs and 20 years back issue of Style and Fashions.
"If I did, I'd have to sign the warrant myself,"
Mustang says vaguely, already at his desk and picking up papers, not even bothering to look at which book.
"Try the lower left. Entire center shelf is military."
The big, obvious one, Ed realizes, which automatically catches the eye of whoever comes in and shows them exactly what one could expect to see. Military histories and officer manuals, political and alchemical books, restricted and exclusive, deliberately shown off with some illicit thrills spiced in. A famous, powerful, arrogant state alchemist, well aware of his own position and prestige. Of course, Mustang builds his bullshit into every bit of his life, down to the book organization. Ed shakes his head a bit and reshelves Amstrian Principle, turning to the bookcases on the left side of the room. This is all hard sciences, but a quick skim of the titles shows all the alchemical stuff is either history or philosophy, and the rest is kind of a really weird mix. "Why do you have so many meteorology books?"
"Humidity and airflow," Mustang says absently.
"Oh, that does make sense. So does all the energetic stuff. But that's more of a no-brainer." A couple of systems handbooks. Fluorine, nitroglycerin, and its pals, sure. More out of place is the handful of cretin books. Not alchemical. Not a single array or formula in them that Ed can tell. And a stack of grain storage manuals for farmers shelved here, of all things. Ed gives up trying to puzzle out the Cretan books and wanders further into more eclectic shelves. Biographies and memoirs, a shit ton of law, some smaller scope regional histories. Ed skims a few, then hangs his legs over the couch armrest and loses the next 2 hours to a history of trade in Kusha Khanate. Mustang scratch of pen and the flip of pages in the periphery. Native in the sunny, quiet study. A presence without demand. Insofar as that's possible, anyway. Not bad, though. Actually, it's a lot like hanging out with Al. It's a thought that makes him want to scratch. So Ed kicks himself up off the couch, back to the shelves. He was gonna behave, be good and professional and adult and sane, go and get another book and work through that. but he finds himself prowling around behind Mustang's desk instead. Mustang doesn't even look up. He's in one of his endless white shirts, but this one's unbuttoned enough that it's sitting loose around his neck, a couple of inches gapped between his skin and the fabric. The skin is as pale as Mustang is everywhere, his hair ungelled so it feathers down the back of his collar. He's not even wearing cologne today. Ed still wants to stick his nose in there and huff like it's paint fumes. He tries to transfer his attention to whatever Mustang's taking notes on, but all he ends up staring at is his hands. Under the tight surgical stitches of the stab wound on his right hand, there's a network of finer, thinner lines. Mustang's got skin like the inside of a Venus flytrap, pale as milk, and so even the razor-fine cuts of the combustion circle he carved to kill lust left distinct scars. But there's no script there. It's as pared down an array as you can get. But even under the jagged ridge of Bradley's stab, Ed can make out the precise angles and coils of the director's, how it condenses the energy into a point like a dam pressurizing a sluice gate. "How dense can you make it?" Ed says, before he even knows he wanted to say anything at all. Mustang doesn't look up.
"Make what?"
Ed picks up a pen from the desk caddy to tap the back of Mustang's hand. "The oxygen. Is it O2 only? Do you have a more generalized atmospheric array?" Mustang pauses, glancing from his hand to Ed's face.
"Why do you ask?"
"Because it'll go faster if you can pull the entire local elemental air composition," Ed says, already half elsewhere in the calculations.
"What will?"
"Ignition." Ed finds himself tapping the pen on his teeth. Maybe he needs some paper. "PV equals NRT. If you can affect density, you can modify your array to pull more molecules and pressurize fast enough to hit the auto-ignition temperature of whatever you're targeting. Not everything, but the flash point of cotton is pretty low." After Yawk Island, teacher had shown him and Al how to make a fire piston out of wood, and using bits of their shirt as kindling. "Anyway, if you're fast enough, you can make fire purely alchemically, without a spark." Mustang just looks at him for a long moment.
"It would rely on accurately estimating the flash points of whatever I'm aiming at," he says finally. "And I'd have to be sure if I'm resorting to this method."
Ed shrugs. "Being able to do something people don't expect is why I'm still alive. If you're in a corner, it's never a bad idea to have more than one thing you can try. Besides, smushing that much air that fast is probably going to at least sting. It'll get you another second. Come on, let's see the compression formula. I bet you 100 cents I can pare it down." Mustang narrows his eyes at him, then picks up his own pen, pulls a fresh sheet of paper towards him, and starts writing out the formulas. Then he sits back and watches Ed read it all over. Ed's eyes narrow more the further he gets. "I can pare it down," he says slowly. Mustang just smiles and gestures for him to go on. "But I'm not gonna, because it would lock you into one set of elemental ratios while targeting, and that costs you in combat situations." Ed finishes, teeth only slightly gritted.
"There are some advantages to specializing," Mustang says modestly. "You're right about pure oxygen making the transmutation faster, by the way, just not safer."
He pulls a glove out of a drawer and drops it flat on the desk, then swivels it around on its side. And all at once, Ed sees the embedded secondary gas subcircuit.
"It's not just oxygen. Half the reason it's not as compressed as it could be is because I use nitrogen to contain and stabilize the channels for the spark."
"Two circles," Ed says, mad about it. "That's not concentric. You're running them parallel."
"It's the only way," Mustang agrees, The ratios have to be different, and there's too much muddling to reconcile them. If the composition is even 10% mixture, risk of interruption to the channel doubles, and then increases exponentially with every added 5%. So they have to be directed separately. The ratios also can't be set, even if you use a range, because every time there's a fluctuation in local air composition, I'd have to adjust the circle to compensate. He starts folding his sheet of formulas, matching the corners together with machine press precision. Normal air is 21% oxygen. At 15% begins impaired judgment. At 12, you're dead drunk and at risk of unconsciousness. On the reverse, 24% is already a risk for hyperoxia, and at 30, even static electricity is enough to spark. So if my immediate surroundings fluctuate beyond a fairly narrow window, you'll rebound, at best. I'm at very high risk of rebounding, burning my own arm off, or blowing up everything in the vicinity. Yes. Mustang puts another crease in the paper. All of which is why I'm not overly worried about someone, say, stealing some gloves and reverse engineering things without me hearing about it. Without the formulas and a lot of practice, they aren't going to achieve much beyond putting themselves in the hospital. Mustang pulls on the glove, picks up the finished paper airplane, and hands it to Ed. Ed rolls his eyes and chucks it, aiming deliberately out the open window. But Mustang snaps, and it doesn't even make it halfway there.
But that does remind me,
he says as he puts the glove away again, looking at Ed.
Don't leave anything here that you wouldn't want be found in a search.
What, you're getting shakedowns? Ed asks, disgruntledly grateful for the topic switch. Did you piss Hughes off or something? What happened to signing your own warrants?
Getting me arrested is much, much harder for my opposition than paying a man a couple hundreds to break in and toss the place while I'm out, Mustang replies. And we're keeping it that way. If my house doesn't have anything worth investigating, they'll go looking somewhere else, or escalate in other ways. Better to keep a little playpen for them to occupy themselves with.
Like who he's fucking. Smoke and mirrors all the way down. Is that why Diane leaves stuff here? Mustang snorts, a surprisingly derisive reaction in context of the lady he's so into.
No, she just never picks up after herself. Although it doesn't hurt, he adds meditatively. Either way, don't expect anything here to be private.
Yeah, Ed's getting that. Sure, whatever, he says, turning back to the shelves. So you keep the real good books in a hole in the middle of a field or what?
I don't think I keep as much alchemical reading as you do,
Mustang says, but he does get up, tug aside a few heavy tomes of tax law in a corner bookcase, and press his hand to the shelf. An array flares blue, inscribed invisibly into the wood, and melts aside to reveal a safe-like cubby with a much smaller row of books. Some Chemitat manuals, a couple of Vartarivieres journals, Salomon's Splendor Solis, the Ars Alchemica, which, okay, those are relatively rare, sure, and expensive, but it's not actually anything that needs to be hidden, especially not to any experienced alchemist. Anybody actually gunning for Mustang's know-how would be looking for that sheet of paper he just vaporized. This stack of books is what Ed would expect from a rich dabbler, not a state alchemist with personal arrays and plenty of practical experience. All the corners are crisp, too. The covers smooth and new, as if bought just to be put in this cubby, left and arranged for someone to find. You've never even opened these, have you? Mustang shrugs.
I read the National Library copies when I was in school. Like I said, I don't think I'm going to provide any alchemical insights you don't already have.
You just showed me your parallel sneak array.
You run parallel arrays all the time.
Mustang takes his hand off the invisible circle, and the cubby melts back into shelf wood again.
So does Alex. Any alchemist working with dirt has to account for random compositions that may throw off their ratios, and you make complex constructs besides. That very first transmutation I saw, for your state exam, you synthesized enough metal to create a spearhead, separate and compositionally distinct from the shaft, but the transmutation itself acted as a whole.
Mustang shelves the tax law books back into place and brushes his hands off.
It's not a new concept, just not common.
Huh. Ed looks down at his own hands. I guess I do that.
This is news,
Mustang says amusedly. I don't know. When stuff's moving that fast, I just kind of do it.
Ed turns his hands over like that's going to give him an answer.
I know all the starter exercises have you build the mental target for the transmutation in consecutive steps, but I only came across those way later. Al did practice those, though. He did say it helps with clarity. Says it's why my stuff comes out blurry, but I don't know. It's honestly just easier to conceptualize targets as a whole.
I see,
Mustang says after a short pause.
Well, you are a genius.
Ed pulls a face. I'm not a genius. I just got superpowers. Mustang looks at him sidelong, bemused.
You think any alchemist could have done what you did at 11?
Ed doesn't say that everybody fucking forgets. Al's a whole year younger and doing everything Ed did and then some. Because in this one case, it's not quite true. Al wasn't doing everything Ed did. It wasn't Al who'd had the fatal idea. If I were a genius, I wouldn't have fucked it up.
Ed puts his hands on his hips and faces Mustang, closing the subject.
Where's your poetry books?
Mustang gives him a slightly nonplussed frown, goes to a shelf in the back, digs through, and finally excavates a withered little booklet whose cover says, Heart Beyond Prose, a collection.
That's it? Ed demands. Because it would be patently insane to assume Mustang has a smaller secret cachet of purely poetry books squirreled away elsewhere the way he had with the alchemy ones.
Love poetry?
What's wrong with love poetry?
It fucking sucks, Ed says disgustedly, flipping through, skimming a couple of pages. This thing's barely a pamphlet and, yep, over half of these are sonnets. Trite garbage all the way down. People get it stupidly wrong. Like, love isn't generic, okay? Lots of people love their brothers, but there's only one Al and only one me, and only one of us. Each instance of love is unique, because each person is unique. Each soul. You can't substitute. And the really good poems understand that, because they make you see what the poet sees. Even though you've never met the person, never even heard of them, those poems touch on something universal, because love is universal, even if each individual instance is discrete, which isn't the same as generic. What? Mustang staring at him with a steadily weirdening look on his face.
And you failed that class?
What's that supposed to mean? Ed says, feeling oddly defensive.
Nothing. It seems a literary analysis that should satisfy any professor. That's all.
Yeah, well, it's not like they were asking for 5 lines on why most love poetry blows butt cheeks, Ed says grouchily, whapping the pamphlet against the desk a few times. He hadn't even tried to reproduce what he'd seen. Try to touch on that universal truth. Even he could recognize when his efforts would be short of target, and he'd never even consider turning any of it in. I told you, the professors don't like me. Why did you even set me on poetry anyway if you don't even have any yourself?
You're a very creative person, Mustang says, still watching him. And art doesn't have a ceiling. You were bored.
Oh, great. Throw me at some macaroni art so I don't run off and dig up any more corpses. Is that it?
Mustang raises his eyebrows.
A friend came and asked for suggestions with a problem. I gave my honest answer.
I don't have a problem.
Not a single one.
Mustang agrees, solemn.
Oh, fuck you. I need food.
Ed grumbles, dropping the pamphlet and abandoning this hole in favor of carbs. He runs into problems immediately, because nothing in this house belongs to a functional human. The onions have disappeared from the fridge, and Mustang really doesn't have fucking anything. The more time Ed spends over here, the more he realizes that the place really is just another display case in the glitzy china shop of Mustang's persona. And Mustang's whole life runs on mirrors, hair gel, and kerosene fumes. Ed gives up in disgust and leaves for takeout. Only there's nothing in decent walking distance, just rows of manicured gated houses and the snack vendors in the park. No wonder there's a weekend food market. Ed starts bringing groceries the next day because he doesn't want to starve to death in this interior decorator's mausoleum. And in any case, when making deals with Mustang, it's important to get your money's worth. The kitchen does have a new oven and gas stove and big sink and granite counters, plenty of room to chop and hang pans. And it turns out that weekend market sells all different kinds of chilies and has an entire stall full of nothing but condiments. Where a lady in approximately 9 headscarves calls him a fucking bitch cheapskate in Xingyi's and is so delighted when he cusses back that he walks away with 6 free jars of unlabeled bean sauce. And then Al has the audacity to call and be all like, "Me and May are in Tongli," and "We found this amazing tea house," and "They had 14 different kinds of meat bun there. I saved the menu." And then read it all out loud, the little bastard. "So how's with you?" Al says, all chirpily after, like Ed isn't drooling buckets. So of course Ed has to be all, "You know what? I'm going to make 15 kinds of meat buns and eat them all myself," and hang up on Al's demon laughter. He spends the week unfucking more sewers with Branson, goes back the next weekend and asks headscarf lady where a cheapskate bitch can get Xiao Longbao in this town, whereupon he gets treated to a litany of woe that encompasses the entire cross-desert mail and transit system, the unreliability of distant in-laws, the difficulty in sourcing a specific spice out of a specific seed out of a specific plant on some possibly mythical mountain, and drags in 4 other vendor and shopping ladies. A tea set gets brought out. Ed comes away 2 hours later with 3 more unlabeled jars, an invitation to meet someone's granddaughter, and a stack of recipes written on the backs of receipts in 3 different handwritings. Some of this stuff he recognizes enough to know he can get Al and May to mail him once they get to Dadu. And for the rest, he can make do. He's not going to half-ass it, though. That's how you get bad food. So in the meantime, he calls Sig. "I want brisket," he moans. "I want sugar flour on a stick and watermelon salad and ribs." And Sig grunts sympathetically, which prompts Ed to complain about Al and tea shops and random grandmas demanding he woo their granddaughters while Sig tisks and chops something in the background. "What are you making?" Ed demands when he's run out of woe. "Tell me how to make it. I'm sick of restaurant food. Nobody ever pickles anything."
"Honey wine, pork, and glazed carrots," Sig says, and Ed can't tell what growls louder, his throat or his stomach.
Sig talks and chops, and Ed paces and claws at the walls and makes grocery lists. The team's off-season right now, and about half of them went home for the summer, somewhere other than Central, so the conditioning practices are less rigid. But less practice means more time for the gym for Ed.
And while he never sticks to the diet guidelines, working out all the time does make him unhinged about protein. Mustang's kitchen doesn't so much get stocked as it becomes a terraforming site. Pans, utensils, spices, some Ed transmutes, the rest he buys. And one day, while he's throwing fetch off the back deck in between rounds of chopping, Chowder loses her toy in the overgrown thickets and leads to a critical discovery. Bastard! Why didn't you tell me there's strawberries in your garden? A chair rolls. Mustang pokes his head out of the study, looking like he's having some difficulty focusing both eyes in the same direction.
What garden?
The one in your backyard! Ed has to stand on his toes to turn out his shirt onto the counter, berries and some slightly mangled mint leaves rolling out of his makeshift basket. Ugh, why do I ask you anything? You're useless. Mustang gets up, though, and trails into the kitchen.
You're cooking?
Not for you. This is for me. And Chowder.
Chowder?
Mustang says, which prompts her to trot curiously through the deck door, see Mustang, and go nuts on him. Mustang takes it the way he usually does when a lady throws herself at him.
I didn't realize we had guests in the home, he tells her in smug delight, ruffling her cheeks as she puts her paws on his chest and drums the shit out of the wall with her tail. I would have gotten out the good china.
You don't have any china. You don't have anything. Survivalist huts in howling wastelands have more in their spice rack than you do. Mustang, who the fuck doesn't have pepper?
I've always made do, Mustang says vaguely, clearly focused on Ed's cutting board. You seem to be managing regardless. What are these? Shallots?
He keeps scratching Chowder with one hand, the other reaching around Ed to grope at the onions. Occasionally, Ed has to confront the haunting suspicion that Mustang might be slightly more than just one miserable inch taller than him. Get your hands off my ingredients, Ed growls, but he's barefoot on slick tile and just put his hands back in the flour, so he can't even make Mustang regret properly.
You ate my onions, Mustang says remindingly,
sidestepping Ed's hip check to try and thieve from the other side.
I'm entitled to compensation.
You're entitled to jack shit! Quit slacking off and go back to work.
If I read any more terrain survey analyses, I'll go blind, Mustang explains, Chowder still hanging off his arm like a dance partner. Again, this time on purpose.
Hawkeye would just make people follow you around and read stuff to you, you fucking slug.
Winsome young aides with melodious voices, whose only job is to do my paperwork and wait on me hand and foot, Mustang muses, still groping. It could have its perks.
Big, angry sergeants off the drill grounds who are late to their own formations, Ed promises darkly, elbowing him off. And if you keep slacking now, you'll only have more to do later. So go back to your pig pen and get grubbing.
Well, I certainly can't be expected to continue sober,
Mustang says in a very reasonable voice as he sets Chowder back on all fours.
And you'll need something to drink with that anyway. Whatever it is.
Liver and onions.
Capital.
Ed just said that in the hope that Mustang's one of those people who thinks liver is inedible. But maybe he shouldn't have run that gamble on a guy who takes his coffee like he's trying to autoclave his esophagus every morning.
Here, we'll need this, Mustang says,
plucking up the bowl of strawberries, taking some bottles out of the liquor cabinet. That, at least, is completely stocked. And starting to slosh things into a mixer.
Did you know I used to like reading?
This, unfortunately, starts what Hawkeye's dog training manuals calls an unproductive behavioral pathway. Ed will open the fridge and make a cutting board out of some chair back, and 20 minutes in, Mustang will inevitably ooze in and cavort about, whining about his life so theatrically that Ed won't even notice he's stolen half the chopped apple until it's already in the bastard's greedy, thieving mouth. And then, when Ed catches him and threatens to put more holes in his hands, he pretends to relent and starts making some drink instead. Only then he makes Ed taste test it, and then suddenly they'll be eating and Mustang will somehow have a plate of his own, slipping chowder bits like he somehow earned the food and associated rights to distribute it. Chowder is no help. She's identified the hand that'll feed her and is doing her damnedest to become spherical on it. Naturally, Ed confronts this, only Mustang never brings up that it's his kitchen and his solitary frying pan Ed's using, like he's forgotten how give and take even works. It's the very first argument Ed would use to bum free food. Mustang just whines about how he's dying and the real assassination plot is to calcify him to his study chair to get eaten alive by moths and paper rot. And then it turns into some complicated anecdote about how some lieutenant walked into him around a corner and panic saluted so hard he threw his coffee over his shoulder, and suddenly the food will be gone and Chowder will be licking her chops and Mustang will be at the sink scrubbing dishes down, still talking. And since Ed's usually half drunk at this point, given Mustang does not stint on the alcohol, all he'll be is lapsed in the window seat, all available faculties occupied by trying not to say anything insane while staring too hard at Mustang's wet forearms. The thing is, when Ed just asks Mustang for shit straight out, the bastard just does it, usually with a pretty dumb look on his face. Like whenever Ed had shaken him down for spare change outside Bradley's office, and Mustang looked like the bus driver closed the doors in his face even though he'd already given his ticket. It's entertaining as hell. Like, somehow this is the one set of circumstances where he doesn't have a face prepared. Like, he's caught off guard, but always ready to take it seriously every time. Ed likes it way too much. And these kitchen meals feel like skirting dangerously close to uncharted territory. It's safer to stick to the status quo. A favor paid, a debt incurred. Transactional. Balanced. If Mustang just forgets how things work, if he somehow starts pretending there's no ledger, well, that's just straight up fucking dangerous. If there's no pushback, what's to stop Ed from knocking the bastard flat on his back and taking all he can fucking get? So it's good that this is all part of that fake relationship deal, probably. Ed wouldn't even be here cooking in Mustang's house if it weren't, so it has to be. And Ed's cooking isn't even anything to write home about. But given the way Mustang lives, he's pretty sure he could serve the bastard slop in a bucket. Mustang's only coming out here to steal tomato slices and bitch as a distraction from work, anyway. Maybe it's just that his transactional scale really is just bigger now, expanded with his job, encompassing broader, less tangible things. Maybe he's not thinking about it. Maybe he just doesn't care. And why would he? There's no real reason for him to worry he'll get savaged like an unfortunate hay bale by the backstropped combine harvester waiting under Ed's ribs. None of this is real.